Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of the Southern Tour podcast. Today, we're having a slightly different sort of episode and talking to a man who 8 years ago followed in the footsteps of Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour and wrote a book that came out in France, and it has the name translated into English, In the Footsteps of the Little Helmsman. And it's Adrien Gombeau who joins me today to talk about his book. Adrien, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
It was really nice to discover your book, and in my slightly limited French, enjoy reading it recently. And I suspect it's a book that many of our listeners won't know about because it was in French and hasn't yet been translated. But the subtitle of the book is China 20 Years After Deng Xiaoping. And the idea of the book is that you followed the route of Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour 20 years after he went, so in 2012. What was your inspiration for undertaking the journey? Can you tell us a little bit about the background?
This book really roots into another book that I wrote a couple of years before called The Man on Tiananmen Square. The Man on Tiananmen Square was written 20 years after Tiananmen Square massacre. And it really was a book not about the man in front of the tank, because nobody really knows who he was and what happened to him, but about the pictures and how they traveled and how they became iconic. So I interviewed all the photographers and also some historians to try to understand what happened on Tiananmen Square. So obviously, Deng Xiaoping was there. I was trying to understand who he was, but I couldn't go that deep because it really was a book about journalism and photographers. So when I finished this book, I was wondering what happened after. And then I learned about this trip that he took in the South, and I thought, hey, this can be a good sequel to this book. And also it's a possibility to do a travel story, which I really like doing, and to take a trip through China. So they had several themes that I thought were interesting. It was, you know, dealing with Deng Xiaoping, doing a trip in China, and also I think it was rooting into something that was interesting to me, was how is it to get old when you're a man of power? You know, how is it to get close to your death when you're a man like Deng Xiaoping? So this was really the basic beginning of this book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think likewise, two of the things that interest me about this story are, I think that the early 90s, that phase of China's story is less widely well known than perhaps the late 70s and through the 80s reform and opening story. And the stories of Deng Xiaoping at home after his kind of pseudo-retirement in 1989, and, you know, a man in search of a purpose in some ways, there's the stories of him walking around his garden, feeding the goldfish and spending time with his grandchildren. As you say, that sense of unfinished business. So you took the trip in 2012. Can you tell us a little bit about what time of year you went and how long you took over the journey?
Well, yes, it was in the summer, I remember, because I went to Sichuan. It was really, really hot.
Yeah.
And I believe I took the first trip I took about a month and a half, maybe 2 months. And then I went to Shanghai in the winter. I separated the Shanghai part because Shanghai is such a big city.
Yeah.
Also, I had a job to do in Paris. You know, I was working. I'm also a film critic, so I had to be back in Paris for the fall and to do my job. So I came back to Shanghai during the winter. And I think it was nice because you had two different seasons, two different feelings. And so so in total, it's probably about 2 months trips.
And so 2012, obviously not that long ago, but we were talking about this before we started recording. It seems an age ago, I think, not just because of COVID, but, you know, in China terms, a lot has changed since 2012. I thought we'd just, because listeners might not be kind of completely clear on the Southern Tour and its chronology, I thought maybe we just quickly kind of cover the main stops. I mean, you started your trip in Sichuan because you went back to the town where Deng Xiaoping was born, which is in eastern Sichuan. And then just to give the kind of a quick chronology of the Southern Tour, so this is January 92, sets out from Beijing with a brief stop in Wuhan, passes south then through to Shenzhen. This is kind of January the 19th, he arrives in Shenzhen and then spends some time there, then to Zhuhai, back through Guangzhou, and then up the east coast to Shanghai, and he spends a fair bit of time in in Shanghai almost 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of the geography of it. Why did you choose to start in, it's Guanggang, isn't it? Deng's hometown.
I think it's important to say that this book is really not about one trip of Deng Xiaoping, but about two trips. It's about the first trip that he took as a young kid when he departed from Guangdong and went to France, where he lived for 6 years as a young student and worker in factories. And about the last trip, which is the Southern Tour. Mm. So the reason I started in Guangdong, because it's the departure of his life, really. He went from Guangdong to France. This is why I wanted to see this little town. And also it's interesting because it's in eastern Sichuan, as you said. It's very remote. And it was interesting for me to put in this book a city that was not a big city, like Guangzhou, like Shanghai, to just show a different China, really, that was still impacted by Deng Xiaoping, especially this one. This is why I started in this eastern Sichuan province. Then I went to Chongqing also, which is the place where he took the boat to go to Shanghai and left for France. So I had this whole complete round trip where I would end up in Shanghai anyway. The last trip ends in Shanghai and the first trip starts in Shanghai.
Yeah, there's a nice synchronicity to that. I went to the old house there. It's quite hard to get there. As you say, it's kind of tucked away in eastern Sichuan. Can you tell listeners a little bit about what it was like there in 2012 and his old house, which is pretty well preserved, isn't it?
Yeah, I had read things about this house, the people who went there before me, that it was a bit clumsy and everything. But when I went there, it was a very modern museum and a well-preserved house. And also a little part of Guangdong where they reproduced the streets of the old times where Deng was a kid. And what I understood was that the reason the city was very prosperous was because of Deng Xiaoping. I mean, people there told me that, you know, people give donations so that the city looks good and sort of reaches Deng's level. You cannot have Deng's birth town to be too remote or too clumsy. So the city was very clean, very big, very modern. I didn't really understand what economy was there except Deng's tourism. And I remember they had a light show every night where they on the big square, and they tell the story of Deng Xiaoping with lasers and everything. So they had no drones at that time, but it was still very impressive, very, very modern. And people there, it was really Deng City. I haven't seen, except maybe in Shenzhen, a city where people were so aware of who Deng Xiaoping was and how important he was. It was very different from the other cities that I had been in during this trip. It was really a city where everybody talked about Deng Xiaoping. Like, I remember I went off the bus, took a taxi to go to my hotel, and the first thing the taxi driver told me was that this is the city where Deng Xiaoping was born.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I have very fond memories of the people there. They were very happy to see me. I was lucky enough to have met someone in Paris, a Chinese man who was from Guangdong. So I had connections there, and I was very well welcomed there. They were very happy to see someone, especially someone from Paris, because, as I said, Deng Xiaoping went to Paris when he left Guangdong. And so, I have very, very fond memories of this of Guangdong. Yeah.
And from there, as you say in the book, you move to Chongqing. But the first destination on the tour for Deng Xiaoping from Beijing was Wuhan, and actually just Wuchang station, where he stops and spends about an hour, doesn't he, walking back and forth talking to local party officials. You spend a bit longer there, and obviously Wuhan is a city that has suddenly become globally well known again after after a long time of being, in the West somewhat obscure. It seems an odd place to stop, doesn't it, in terms of the purpose of his trip. Most of the other, all of the other destinations were coastal regions. What was your sense of perhaps his purpose in stopping in Wuhan?
Well, I think it was everything that he disliked, really. It was a city that was stuck, it was an old industry city that was underdeveloped in his views. So he stopped there to basically yell at people and tell them that it was impossible for them to stay in this situation. I think that's why he didn't really go off the station too. Because I don't even want to see you. and what was amazing is that when you go there in 2012 and even more now, it's a very modern city now.
Yeah.
So it's like if his message really passed on to people. I mean, obviously there are other reasons why it became a big city that it is today. But still, you can imagine when he went there how remote it was, and how underdeveloped it was, and how angry he was at these people. So yeah, it's a very strange stop. I could have done like he did and just stayed a couple hours in the train station, but then there would have been not much to write about. And then it's a fascinating city because for other reasons as well. I mean, you know, for the history of the city, the history of the Communist Party of China. So, and he had been there before in various ways and in various stages of his life. So it was an interesting place to visit as well at that time. It was also, I think, 2012. It was quite advanced, but still it was not as developed as the coastal cities. So it was really interesting to see what was going on in the region in 2012. Another reason is that it's a big capital for the French industry of automobiles. And Deng used to work in France in those factories. So when I did the French part of my book, I visited several factories and they were really dying. They were really, really, you could feel that there was no energy there. And I wanted to go to a big factory in China where you could feel the energy and the economy booming, as a contrast to what I would see when I was visiting the factories where Deng was working when he was staying in France. So that was one of the reasons, that was one of the things that I was looking for when I went to Wuhan.
And did you find that difference? I mean, you visited some of the automobile factories there.
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, the car factories were really impressive. I had never seen anything like that. Never big, I mean, I don't visit car factories that often when I'm traveling anyway, but this was really impressive. It was out of the town, and it was like another town, another you know, Wuhan. The whole factory was like a whole town in itself, and you could definitely feel the energy and the young people working there. They were all very, very young people, not all of them coming from Wuhan, so they had come here for working. And it, you could almost feel, I guess, if you'd been to Guangzhou in the 80s, you could have probably have had that feeling that you could still get in Wuhan in the 2010s.
From there, I mean, as I say, it's a very brief stop that he makes in Wuhan, and then carries on another overnight train journey to end up in Shenzhen, which in many ways is the sort of centerpiece of his journey. It's a city that still today, you know, I was there in 2019, and he is still, you know, revered there by lots of people you meet, and there's statues of him and all sorts of other kind of physical memory of him on display there. Did you get that sense as well? Is it kind of feeling like Deng's city?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, when I was talking about Deng Xiaoping to people in other towns, not only during this trip, but elsewhere in Beijing or when I was traveling in China, I didn't feel that he was that well recognized. Somehow Mao Zedong was taking all the credits, which is probably something that Deng Xiaoping was okay with. But when you get to Shenzhen, you understand that this is different. This is his city. He's, you know, his project, and people know about it through the statues, the portraits, and I guess the whole mythology that was built around Shenzhen. One of the things I regret is that when I wrote this book, I didn't realize that Shenzhen was really not ever the small duck pound that people thought it was. It's something that we realized very recently. All the books that I had read and the testimonies that I had in the early 2010s were about a village turned into a megapolis by Deng Xiaoping. We know now that it's more complicated than this. But at that time, I didn't know. So I was really into this mythology myself of Shenzhen, with a magic touch turned into a super city by the hand of Deng Xiaoping. But I mean, even if it's not completely true, it still is, because this is what people believe. And you can still feel this atmosphere in Shenzhen, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a well-perpetuated myth. And a couple of episodes ago, I spoke to Juan Du, who's written a recent book, The Shenzhen Experiment, which talks in a bit more detail about the kind of origin myths of the city. I mean, that said, obviously there were, you know, about 300,000 people living there in 1980 when it's declared as an SCZ. Mm-hmm. But if you look at photos from the early 80s, transformation is still remarkable. In Shenzhen. And the comparison between Shenzhen and Deng's next destination, which is across the Pearl River in Zhuhai, you know, one of the other original SCZs. But it has a very different feel to Shenzhen. It feels a more livable city. I can imagine living in Zhuhai quite happily. You know, I think it's called the City of 100 Islands in Chinese. Lots of little islands, you know, quite nice beaches and things. But it definitely has that different feel. And out of those original four SCZs, Shenzhen was very much the success story. How did the contrast feel to you when you traveled from Shenzhen to Zhuhai?
Zhuhai also has a lot of big changes in the recent years, I guess. What was interesting, I think, in Zhuhai and still is that it's next to Macau, whereas Shenzhen is next to Hong Kong, as you know. Mm. So this big Lisboa casino that you see from Zhuhai, and you know, not everybody's able has a chance to cross the border, so it has this border feeling where you can feel the money of Macau. You can see it. It's shining. It's gold. And you can see it from the beach, really. Also, it has this next to Macau feeling with prostitution, not gambles, obviously, but it has this kind of bizarre feeling that you don't really have in Shenzhen, which is more about business. But the two cities, I think, have a common adventure. I mean, I remember the people that I met. When I went to Zhuhai, I went to a tattoo parlor, and the people who owned it were people from Xi'an. They had moved to the south because of Deng Xiaoping, and their son was now doing the tattoo things. Mm. And you still had this kind of Californian, you know, atmosphere where you could, if you speak to people, many of them are not from Zhuhai or from Shenzhen, they're from elsewhere, and they tried their luck. You know, in the early 90s, after the Southern Tour, they heard about it somehow, and they try to go south, like you go west, and try to do something different and make a living. So this, I think, they have in common. I mean, I haven't really met anyone who was from Zhuhai or from Shenzhen. You know, all the people that I met, they came here for a reason, for working. And some of them had difficulties. It was not that easy to make it into Shenzhen or into Zhuhai. There was like a border, you know. And you wouldn't really settle there and, you know, like an adventurer and say, this is my home. So they all had interesting stories of I wouldn't say immigration because they were Chinese, but still, you know. And you could find that in Shenzhen and you could find that in Zhuhai as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little known fact still with Shenzhen that it was fenced off. There was what was called the second line where they had, you know, it was a fenced off area with checkpoints. Certainly in the early days of the SCZs, it was, as you say, an area that not everybody could access. And, you know, he's in Zhuhai, he goes to some factories, doesn't he? Some of the pharmaceutical factories and engineering factories as well. He also seems to have a bit of a thing for buildings with revolving restaurants, because I think he goes to the Guo Mao building in Shenzhen, which was once China's tallest building, which has a revolving restaurant there. And there's another one on the coast in Zhuhai. How long did you spend in this part of Guangdong?
About 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
I think of that, yeah. And also, what I remember from the Shenzhen tour is that he went to this reproduction of China, the little China.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's an amusement park. So, but it's more than this. I mean, when you think that someone like Deng Xiaoping would go there and have his picture taken in an amusement park, it means that it was more than an amusement park. And so I spent a full day there and took the park next to it, which is the same thing, but it's a reproduction of the world without China, of course. You can't have little China. And I think it was an interesting idea that you had little China you know, in one part of the park and Little World next to it.
Mm.
And the fact that, well, I don't think Little World existed when Van Gogh was there, but he took his picture next to the Potala.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can see that it was not just an amusement park, it was a historical monument, a project that in his southern tour, he would also tour the rest of China through this reproduction of China. And I met a guy who took a picture of him there. And he became sort of a celebrity just because he took one picture of Deng Xiaoping. He was an interesting fellow. And he had this crazy life where he went to Shenzhen himself, pretending he was someone else, and with a passport that was not his. And he settled there and became a photographer. So that was the memory that I have of meeting people like that and going to places like that, like this small world. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was China's first theme park. And it's interesting you raise that picture of him in front of the Potala Palace, because so much of the symbolism of the journey seems kind of casual. You know, there was the impression that he was taking a vacation, which he was something he did. I mean, he did winter in Shanghai quite often, or in the south. So it wasn't beyond the realms of possibility. But I think the image that's crafted, the photos that are released of him with his family, with his grandchildren, I think there was a good degree of kind of calculation behind the image that he was portraying of himself in the wake, obviously, of recent history. And I mean, I went to that theme park and kind of expecting to find it pretty awful, but actually I quite enjoyed it.
I went there several times when I was traveling in Hong Kong as well, and it's not that far, so I would go there. And it was interesting to go there over the years in different period of times. When you'd go there before 2010, and maybe in the early 2000s, I guess, you still had a lot of Chinese people who couldn't travel out of China who would go there and took it very seriously because they knew they would never see the real Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
So it was not for fun. It was really a way to see the world and to see things that you could not imagine seeing, you know, in your life. So it was very moving to go there and to talk to people and to see them really amazed with the outside world.
Mm.
And I mean, I think Shenzhen was also a door to the outside world. This is why the park is there. I mean, there's another small world in Beijing, but that's different. And in Shenzhen, in this building, you also have a museum of Hong Kong where they reproduce, you know, movie posters of Hong Kong films and they sort of reproduce streets of Hong Kong. I don't know if it's still there, but anyway, it was a way that this is as far as you can go, but this is a hint of what you could see if you could cross this border. So it's a very moving place, really, because you can feel how big China is and still how isolated it was when the border were closed for most of the people.
You know, the other thing I found fascinating in Shenzhen Museum was the fact that they had preserved so much of the paraphernalia from the Southern Tour. So there's the spade that he uses to plant the tree in the botanical gardens. Mm-hmm. There's the van that he drove around in, or the minibus rather, that he drove around in. There's his bedroom, like the whole bedroom, all of the furniture, the bed and everything is, and his desk and everything is reproduced there. It seems to sort of almost fetishize, you know, Deng's visit, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. I think everybody was aware that the situation of Shenzhen was a Deng Xiaoping project. I mean, everybody knew that. And yes, I did feel that the way people talked about him was really the way other people talk about Mao Zedong in elsewhere China.
Yeah.
Now, with one exception, though, next to Shenzhen, there's this village of painters, you know, they're not great artists. They paint, you know, the Venice that you would see if you go to your pizzeria, or they paint many, like it's probably the place where they paint the highest number of Mona Lisas in the world. And so there was this one painter, and he was doing portraits of politicians.
Mm.
And he had all sorts of politicians, but what he was doing was really making Mao Zedong, you know, daily.
Mm.
And so I asked him, why do you paint you know, that many Mao Zedong? He said, because I sell a lot of Mao Zedong because people buy them. And then I said, you know, this is Shenzhen. How about Deng Xiaoping? He said, well, I do paint some, but the clients who buy me Deng Xiaoping are people who already have a Mao Zedong. This I think is interesting. You know, it tells you, and he had even less other politicians. Like, you know, he didn't really have any other politician other than Mao and Deng Xiaoping. And he had quite a few others, but very rarely.
Mm.
And he didn't have really any Americans. He had Napoleon as he said, yeah, Napoleons, they're made for, if you have a Western type villa and you have a staircase, then you'd put a Napoleon in it. And I said, then where do you put Mao Zedong? He said, if you're a businessman, you put it behind your desk so that, you know, when you have a business meeting, the people will face you and Mao Zedong.
Mm.
And that will help with the negotiation. You know, it will make you look stronger if you have a Mao Zedong. Deng Xiaoping, you didn't really know how to use it. There was, you know, if you had a Western staircase, you wouldn't put Deng Xiaoping. If you're a businessman, you don't really want Deng Xiaoping behind you. So I think it was really interesting to hear this one talk, because it was really telling you about the legacy of Deng Xiaoping. He was the man who built the city, who also kind of built modern China. But then where do you put his portrait? What do you do with the figure of Deng Xiaoping? The painter didn't really know, though he was still selling some Deng Xiaoping, you know, painting. Same the tattoo parlor in Zhuhai. He told me that he had tattooed a few Mao Zedong, but never Deng Xiaoping.
As we've said, Deng did think carefully about his image, but in a way, a lot of it was to do with the pragmatic outcome, right? I mean, the Southern Tour, the idea was to take this journey in order to persuade those back in Beijing that he was right, so that they should change course again. So in a way, the purpose of the myth-making was slightly different, I guess.
Yeah. I think also he was a man who had survived incredible dangers with this idea of staying in the shadows.
Yes.
If he had, you know, tried to do the cult of personality while Mao Zedong was alive, he'd probably have been killed, you know.
Mm. Mm.
So the fact that he was low profile was probably one of the things that, you know, helped him get through these incredible moments that he went through. So maybe he kept that also.
Mm.
He was never really, like, it's interesting how he was never really interested in his appearance.
Mm.
Never really tried to look good or to, you know, I don't think he really cared about that. Even though he was charismatic because he was Deng Xiaoping, he was not trying to, you know, to show off or anything. And then this is Shenzhen is the place where he is allowed to do that somehow.
Yeah, you see his image. I mean, there's the statue on top of the hill that kind of looks down over that central axis of Shenzhen, and then the famous billboard, which has been there for a long time and changed in terms of sort of the imagery and the language over, you know, over the years. So he spends the majority of his time in Guangdong, in Shenzhen and Zhuhai, and then a brief stop in Guangzhou again on his way to Shanghai. And Shanghai, he spends about 3 weeks there. He's there for the Lunar New Year. Does, again, similar sorts of things where he will visit development zones and factories. But, you know, his purpose in going to Shanghai was slightly different, right? I mean, he went to Shenzhen to consolidate and encourage more of the same. Going to Shanghai, he admits that to some extent Shanghai has been left behind, that he should have encourage the opening up of Shanghai earlier.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find his legacy there when you traveled to Shanghai?
It was not as obvious as in Shenzhen. I mean, as you know, there was no big statues or anything, but still, I think people in Shanghai knew about the Southern Tour much more than in Wuhan, for example, because there is Pudong, obviously. So the main thing for me was to try to understand what Pudong was. So I spent a lot of time there trying to speak to real Pudong people who had started business during the Deng era. It was interesting. They were building the Disneyland, I think, at that time.
Right,
so you had still farmers there, and you knew that you were meeting the last farmers, which I'm not sure that Disneyland could be, you know, seen as the conclusion of the Southern Tour, but it was still symbolically, you know, the opening of that, the end of Pudong as something that is exterior to Puxi. And I still met people who still spoke Pudonghua, which is like the local, it's not Shanghaihua, it's another language. Older people, you know. So this to me was interesting, was what happened to Pudong. Another thing that I was looking for is in the Cemetery of the Heroes, which is an interesting place. I was looking for Deng's first wife's graves. I was also interested in his personal life, I think, something that is less studied. And I tried to look for her grave in the middle of these huge statues. And it's just a very, very small grave. One of the things that I enjoyed working on this book was also the revolution and how some people become heroes and some people are just forgotten. And the cemetery is interesting for that because it has all these huge statues and then you have the smaller graves of people who either because they did the wrong choices at some times or because they were just unlucky or forgotten. It's really a collective history. So yeah, that's what I remember about Shanghai. I was also working on Deng Xiaoping's life in Shanghai, not during the Southern Tour, but before as a young person. Mythology of the Shanghai in the 30s, really, gangster things and all that.
Yeah, no, I went to the cemetery as well. I remember when I arrived and there was a kind of, you know, reception desk thing and the guy gave me a map. Uh-huh. Quite a young guy. And I said, I'm interested in Deng Xiaoping and I'm looking for the grave of his first wife. And this, you know, I guess this guy was maybe in his late teens, early 20s, and he had no idea what I was talking about. And then there was an older guy sort of standing, as is often the case, like standing just smoking a cigarette, who's clearly kind of some sort of, you know, overseer of the whole thing. And he said, oh, yes, no, I know who you're talking about. And he told me where to go. And as you say, it's tucked away right at the back in a row of two or three rows of quite small, modest headstones. Mm-hmm. And inside the museum, there is a picture of her, but it doesn't mention that it was Deng's wife, and I found that fascinating. You know, as you say, kind of speaks to the carefully cultivated image of, you know, obviously his relationship with Zhuo Lin, you know, was, you know, talked about as this great romance, and so, you know, his previous marriages were played down to some extent. But and then you know, with Pudong, I actually lived in Shanghai whilst they were building Shanghai Disneyland, and I lived not actually far away from where it was, and I would cycle around there quite a lot, and off the main streets you would come across these little farms, and you know, it's still quite agricultural near where I lived. If you cycle for a few minutes, it looks so impressive, Pudong, doesn't it? Certainly the bit on the river, it's hard to conceptualize that it wasn't actually that long ago. If you look at photos from the early 90s, actually it hadn't really developed very much. It was only really post, you know, the early 90s that Pudong grows up in that way.
You had like a curtain of buildings.
One thing I'm interested in talking about this is the gap between myth and reality around this journey that he made. And I think there's always a danger, you know, with talking about the Southern Tour. It's such an important event in Chinese, in the kind of the CCP historiography. But I'm always conscious of how much of this is me having internalized what the CCP want me to believe about this journey. And I just wondered what your take on that was, you know, having done the journey and read around the subject, and did you come away from it feeling like this was a, you know, hugely decisive and important moment that kind of meant China corrected course and became the economic powerhouse it was, or did you see it in a slightly different way after you finished your research?
Well, you know, as you know, Thousand Tours are meant to be mythicals. And he was going in the footsteps of the great emperors before him. He knew that. I mean, Qing Shi Huangdi did a Thousand Tour, Kangxi did a Thousand Tour, Qianlong did a Thousand Tour. So every great emperor somehow has to do a Thousand Tour. So obviously he was getting into this mythology himself. As an important figure in the history of China. So it has to do with this mythology. What I found interesting was also the mythology that the West has done through this tour. I mean, I'd read books where they say, you know, that he was facing the crowd in Shenzhen and said, get rich. And people were like screaming and everything. And then you look and there's no pictures of him facing any crowd, really. If you look at the stories that have been printed at the time, it was always, oh, Deng Xiaoping was there 2 days ago, or Deng Xiaoping was there last week. Yeah. I'm not sure that if you had been in Shenzhen in 1992, you'd know that Deng Xiaoping was in town. It wasn't that much of a big thing when he was doing it. It became big after.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that he could not speak to the crowd was also that he was a very sick man. Mm-hmm. So this mythology also is kind of touching. I mean, I had read texts in Chinese where they'd say, you know, oh, in 1992, he was speaking with his Sichuan accent again, which is why people could not understand him. The truth is he had Parkinson's disease, which causes elocution problems. He was absolutely unable to have big speeches to the crowd and yell at people. He was not this politician anymore. He was never really this kind of politician anyway. But he would speak, you know, in a very low tone to his daughter, who would somehow translate what the father was saying. That's the man he was back then. So I don't think he could have faced, you know, big crowds, or it was not like, you know, those tours that they do in America when they're campaigning, which is how it was portrayed in, at least in the French press. And I guess I think in the American or English press that I read before I did the tour. And I realized that this never happened. It was impossible. So the mythology of Deng Xiaoping also has to do with his physical condition.
Yeah.
You know, he would take naps most of the time. He was sleeping a lot because he was very tired, which I think, you know, as I said at the beginning, made it interesting for me, is how do you age as a man of power? How do you use your last strengths to do what you have to do? And then you have to embrace the myth to kind of, you know, make people believe that you're still that powerful young man that you were, but you're not really. You have to rely on other things, including mythology.
And it's interesting what you say about, you know, giving speeches and the photos that there are of him meeting with party official. It's notable that his daughter is always there. So on the platform at Wuchang, she is there. And you know, as you say, not only his speech, but his hearing was poor. I mean, he was an old man, wasn't he? 88 years old at this point. And of course, it wasn't really reported on at the time, was it? I mean, it was only when he got back to Beijing, really, that the Southern Tour was fully reported on by Chinese media, once they kind of realised that the cat was out of the bag.
Yes.
And obviously, because in Hong Kong, it had been reported on, and people in Guangdong got Hong Kong, you know, radio, and so that they kind of became a secret to some extent.
Yeah, but it wasn't that much of a big thing, really, at the time.
No.
So this mythology is interesting. And also in Guang'an, the mythology of Deng Xiaoping was interesting, now that I think back. People loved him, but at that time, there was always this question, why did he never came back to Guang'an? He was stationed in Sichuan for a while. He stayed in Chongqing. He never came back to Guang'an. And so they show you this chair and they tell you, yeah, he never came back, but he always traveled with this chair that was made in Guan'an. So they would sit there and think about the old country. But when you think of the Thousand Tour, of this old man trying to change China at the age of 88, being very sick, close to death, he's a man who never really looked back, which is interesting when you think of taking a trip to pass your message, is really considering your life as a trip. And not looking back to where you came from, but, you know, looking to the next destination, really. And the mythology of Guan'an is sad in a way, because he left when he was a teenager and he never came back, and he never really wanted to come back. So I guess, the idea of taking a trip really relates to who he was as a person throughout his whole life, until the last years.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I mean, I would encourage listeners to, if their French is up to it, get hold of a copy of the book. I'll put a link in the show notes to it. And no chance, I suppose, that it'll be translated, you don't think, Adrian?
I'm not sure. It's a bit old, I guess, for a translation. And to tell you the truth, I think I've written about 10 books now. this one is really one that really didn't reach that much of an audience. I think people still wonder who Deng Xiaoping was.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had written a biography on Mao Zedong, it would have been another story. But I remember when the book was released, it was a lot of work, a lot of trips to China and a lot of reading. And I was very disappointed because I didn't get that much press, didn't do that many interviews. I did some. And the reason is that nobody really knew who Deng Xiaoping was. I mean, it was very interesting for me to realize that, yeah, even though he's the man who changed China, and China really changes the world and the world that we live in today, if China is that important, it's also a lot to do with Deng Xiaoping's vision.
Yeah.
But still, when you do put out a book on Deng Xiaoping, people don't really seem to understand what you're doing. And so it was a sad conclusion, but an interesting one as well for this book.
Well, no, and I found it fascinating to read about the trip in 2012. And thanks again so much for taking the time today, Adrian. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much.